Teach the older women to be reverent in the way they live. Verse 3. Not to be slanderers, addicted to much wine, but to teach what is good. Then they can train the younger women. This is what younger women are supposed to learn. To love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, to be pure, to be busy at home, to be kind, to be subject to their husbands, so that no one will malign the word of God. Women have some things to learn as they're younger, and a larger set of things to learn as they're older. Look what it says to guys, though. Teach the older men to be temperate, worthy of respect, self-controlled, and sound in faith, and love and endurance. What does it say to the younger men? Encourage young men to be self-controlled. Guys deal with the same basic thing all the way through their life. They can add a few things as they get older. But the message is the same. Actually, the word here in Greek is a word that means to live your life with your life controlled by your mind. That's the idea here. Your mind knows some things about how to live and what's right and what's wrong, and you need to live your life controlled by your mind. It's the same word it's used whenever the scripture says that God's not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and, quote, self-control, or a sound mind, some translations say. The Greek word is sophrosyne. It means that your mind's in charge. You put your wisdom in charge of your life. And I think the RSV says to be sensible. And that's what women are usually trying to tell their husbands. Be sensible. You know, guys get big ideas, want to run off and do this and do that and do the other. Scripture says to you guys, whenever you're younger, be sensible. As you're older, be sensible. And add a few things to that. All the way through midlife crisis, the biggest struggle you're going to have is being sensible. Because as you're heart and mind do war, you want to let your emotions run your life instead of your head. And did you know you choose your emotions? God chooses his. God is not subject to his emotions. The emotions of God are subject to God. If God is going to be angry, it's not because all of a sudden he got ticked and boom! He doesn't do that. If God is angry, it's because it's time to be angry. Whenever I first read that about God, and then studied it out in the scripture, I thought, boy, that is weird. And then I found out we do the same thing. We choose our emotions, every one of us. If you're down, thoroughly depressed, lying, sucking your thumb in a fetal position on the floor, and the house gets on fire, you know, the depression just doesn't last. If you're just going off, you know, exploding and lava, hot lava flowing all over everything, just with the anger and the wrath, and the phone rings, and it's somebody you need to impress. You know, if it's a girl, a guy calls, or a girl calls, or your boss calls. Oh, yes, how are you? Oh, just fine, thank you. Yeah. Phone hangs up, and here we go again. Emotions tug at us. But we choose whether or not to give in to them. And one of the big struggles in the middle years, guys, is as you had trouble being sensible early on and are going to still have trouble being sensible later on, you just need to really be sensible right now. So if you can keep that in mind, you'll go a long ways. It's not a new lesson, just eighth grade instead of first. Now we're going to look at something different in our time together this morning. What we're going to look at is leadership. I'd like to share with you some essentials of leadership that flow in any direction that leadership goes. Now, everyone has to deal with leadership. You deal with leadership on the job. You deal with leadership in the home. If you're a parent, you're trying to lead children. If you are working in community life or a church life, you may have leadership either of children or of adults. The same fundamental principles of leadership work no matter what direction you turn. This is true for husbands, it's true for mothers, it's true for CEOs, it's true for supervisors, it's true for foremen, it's true for lieutenants, and true for generals. The same principles flow all the way through life. And it's very helpful if you can grasp what some of these are. I'm not going to cover the whole gamut, but what I'm going to do is take a look at the essence of leadership. And we're going to look in at the very end of this at some of the ways that you build your leadership in the lives of people. Leadership can be approached from a variety of angles, from the area of definition. We can approach it from the area of tasks. But what I'm going to try to do is just sort of pull the essence out of several different aspects of leadership and knit them together for an understanding of leadership and that fits all arenas, whether military or business or home or community or church. First of all, as we look at leadership, leadership has one goal. Anyone who's a leader has one goal. We could define leadership differently. If you study different authors, you'll find different definitions. Of course, the most fundamental one is, John Hawkins said the other day, leaders have followers. And you may have heard the old leadership proverb. You heard that? He who thinketh he leadeth, whom no one followeth, merely taketh a walk. You know that one? It's easy to become a legend in your own mind and assume that you're a leader because you have knowledge or information, but you're really a leader if you have followers. Leaders do a lot of other things, though. You'll find some authors who focus, say that leaders are those who basically interpret reality for us. They tell us what's important. You'll find a variety of definitions, and the definitions are helpful. What I'm looking at is more functional. Leaders have a goal. Leaders come into existence especially because something needs to be done. There's a mission to be carried out. And from my understanding of leadership, the broad goal is to get a quality job done through others in such a way they want to continue with you. There's a quality job. You don't need a leader for an ordinary job. You know, if you're just going to go out and muck around a little bit, you don't need a leader. Everybody just go muck around and come back in. We don't need a leader. But if we got to do something in a certain amount of time, and it has to be a certain level, then we need someone to coordinate the work, to pull us together, and to lead us forward to get this thing done. A quality job. If you're on campus just to do campus ministry, then you really need to rethink what you're doing. You know, we're out to do something in the lives of people that has eternal impact. We're out to make a difference in the world if you're in the ministry. If you're in business and you are wanting to do business, well, if all you're doing is just going out to do business, now you're going to be in trouble. As a matter of fact, before long, you're going to be a dinosaur. As a matter of fact, your egg may never hatch. You know, if you go into business in this day and time, you had better be ready to perform quality services or produce quality products, because one round with a bad product, given the tremendous sources available today to people, means that people don't ever come back again. I went to a hamburger stand recently, a new chain that's come through the area, a drive-through type hamburger stand. I'd seen them for a while, and I thought, well, I'll try this out. So I drove through and ordered a large Coke. I wasn't willing to try the hamburger yet. I just want to see what kind of service they had. And they gave me this. It was a huge Coke. That looked good for the price. Whenever I opened up the Coke, the back side of the styrofoam cup was missing a chunk about an inch wide, about an inch deep. I looked down inside the Coke, and there's a little thing he's floating on top of it from styrofoam. And I didn't know what else was in there. I poured it out the window and made a decision. I'm never going back to that place. You know, you don't get a second chance. You have to do quality work. You blow quality, you blow business. If you are trying to live in home life, it's really hard to do quality things at home, primarily because there are so many of them to do, particularly as kids get older. But, you know, children have to perceive that it's good for them that you are leader. They have to experience some kind of quality to life. That makes it really, really worth the discipline they have to undergo to follow you. And as kids get older, you know, little ones don't know any different. But as kids get older and older, moving toward teenage years, they need to perceive from their angle on life that something good is taking place for them. And there is strain, there is stress in trying to follow leadership, but overall it's worth it. Quality. We're out to do something quality. There's something that needs to be done. In such a way that people want to continue with you, it is possible to do high-level quality through people. You know, leaders don't operate alone. They operate with others. It's possible to do high-level quality through people in such a way that they don't ever want to do this thing again. We've taken people through training programs that have been on the market. And the training programs have been so voluminous, so demanding, and existed for so long that whenever we finish, people have said, I'm glad that's over. And the guy who's number two with me has been for years. He's a wise man. He said, you know, whenever people at the end of a training program say, oh, I'm glad that's over, he said, you don't ever want to do that training program again. He said, what they need to be saying at the end of the training program is, man, why do we quit so soon? Or, isn't there any more? Isn't there a part two? And what he's talking about is quality. Quality done in such a way that there's an esprit de corps and a spring to the step of the people who are experiencing this thing. So leaders are people who need to continue with followers, not just have followers one time, but continue with followers. Leaders have a goal. Leaders also have two sources of authority. Authority is the right to lead. Something gives you the right to exert this influence on others to get the quality job done. Authority comes from, in one of two ways, it exerts itself one of two ways, comes from one of two sources. One way it exerts itself is the ability to do rewards and punishment. This ability is given by an institution. It's called positional leadership. The name of it is positional leadership. The ability to do reward and punishment. And people who can reward you and punish you can exert leadership in your life. You know, you're in a 7-Eleven, getting ready to buy something at night. Two guys break in, sawed off shotguns, holler, hit the floor! You say, yes, sir. We now have a leader. Here's reward and punishment in the extreme. And as long as they want to lead, it's just fine with me. Appreciate if they'd leave sooner rather than later, but they're in charge. In business, now people exercise leadership the same way. Someone's a department head, supervisor on a shift, they have power to do reward and punishment. They can, if you are good, they continue your pay. If you do better, they may raise your pay. They may recommend you for a promotion. If you do poorly or you just dink around and don't get to work on time and all these other things, they can dock your pay or they may even fire you. They have a certain amount of power for reward and punishment. That power comes from the institution that they work for. In the Christian ministry, more people feel like they have more power than they really do. You know, I pastor congregation, and one of the things that's true about me is that I don't fire them, they fire me. So my leadership is very complicated in this area. But there's a powerful reward and punishment. Sometimes that reward and punishment can be more emotional. Now with love and rejection, expressions of acceptance or rejection, tends to be very damaging when it is. Whenever we try to raise children with that kind of reward and punishment, you do what I like, I love you. You don't do what I like, I despise you. Whenever you do that, you produce damaged kids. As a parent, you do have the power to discipline, and as a parent needs to use that wisely. This is not wrong, it's just that it's not powerful enough in the right kind of way. There's another power, another basis of authority. One is position and the ability to reward and punish. Whether the position is department head or bank robber, you know, I have the power to reward and punish. The other is respect. respect is given to me not by an institution, but by my followers. And it operates by influence. Influence is a power to impact others in thought or dealing or action without command or reward and punishment. Whenever I have respect among people in a given arena and I'm moving a certain direction, people look at me and they move with me. If I have the respect of my children, then we may have some tension in our relationship, but as I exert direction, they go with me. If I have the respect of my wife in a given situation, then she will go with me. We may have sit-down dialogue over things, but she'll go with me. If I'm a supervisor, I've got the respect of those that work under me. I have a power to lead them and get the job done that someone else doesn't have who just has authority from the institution. Two bases of authority. Respect flows like this. Let's say influence. Influence flows from respect. Respect comes from something demonstrated. Three things demonstrated repeatedly. Actually, not demonstrated, but perceived. It's not enough to demonstrate it. People have to see these things. If you're not communicating these, you need to figure out how to communicate them in a way that people actually see them. Number one is character, especially integrity. Number two is competence, your capability. And number three is your commitment to the task at hand and to your people. Character, we don't follow people very closely who are liars. We don't respect them, and we never know when they're going to deceive us and they're going to use us. If you are a department head or a CEO or whatever you are, and you don't keep your word to people, people watch, and they note that. And they always follow you tentatively because they never know when you're going to fail or whenever you're just flat out going to use them. You've got to have integrity. Beyond integrity, you need to be setting the pace character-wise in a lot of other areas. As you are a person of high character, you are respectable. You have respect. You have the opportunity to exert influence. In your home, you keep your word to your wife, you keep your word to your children, you keep your word to your husband, you develop respect. If you violate your word continually, or when you violate your word, you sort of whistle past the graveyard, you know. We didn't hear what I said. And we pretend these things never occurred, and we don't really take ownership of our failure, ask forgiveness, then people write that down mentally. Our kids write it down. And that's one more reason not to follow you. So you must exhibit character. Whenever you study leadership at its best, you always find that leadership at its best has high character. Now, it's possible to have powerful leadership without character. It is possible. Hitler was a good example. Now, there were a few things that he was able to accomplish that allowed him to lead the masses in delusion as he appealed to the wrong things inside of people. You know, that kind of leadership is never creative. It's always destructive. It destroys people. But normal, sane people want people of character to lead them. Second thing is competence. There are some competencies you need to have. Leadership competencies are really needed. We don't like to follow clutches. You like to follow someone who doesn't know what they're doing? No. Especially, you don't want to follow them hard. You don't want to follow them closely. There are certain basic things about your jobs that you need to learn. You need to learn how to lead Bible studies. You need to learn how to speak publicly. You need to learn some basic things about organizing. You need to learn some things about counseling. Now, you're not going to be professional counselors, most of you, but you're going to be doing this kind of thing over and over and over again, and you need to develop skill in these things. If you don't have skill, you can develop skill. If you're a klutz when it comes to speaking, you raise a question of competence. So, figure out how to speak. One of the best things I ever went through on speaking was Gene Moore's tape on public speaking out of Max's library. And it was worth more than the seminary course I had on preaching. Now, frankly, it was a great tape, just one brief tape. Gave me a lot of good insight on speaking. Same with Bible study leading. The first Bible study I ever led, I was so excited about Jesus. I'd just finally come to the conclusion that I had more certainty about my Christian faith than I did about certain things as a physicist. I finally worked through that. And I was trying to lead this group discussion, and I don't know exactly how it all worked out, but we ended up way out on some limb of some minor issue, and one person in the group, actually, we were sitting on the floor, one person actually laid down and snored. I walked away thinking, I've got to learn how to do this. I can't spend the rest of my life watching people snore. You know, there are skills there you can learn. If you will actually dig and try to make it happen. If you don't develop the skill, you constantly are raising the issue for the people who are following you. Is this person really adequate to lead me? Now, the day you die, there will still be skills you don't have. But basic skills in dealing with people and leading groups you need to develop. Now, this is true for a supervisor on the job. Basic human relation skills are needed. Same with a dad in relating to children. There are some things you need to learn about relating to children at the different ages they are. It's not enough to have children. You've got to relate to them. Same with mom and dad in communicating. Men and women are very different in their communications patterns. Those communications continually trip up married couples. They get into arguments just over differences in communication styles. So there's some skills you need to pick up. There are competencies, especially related to leadership. There's a book called The Leadership Challenge. It's in the second edition. John's got a copy. Hold that up, would you, John? This is done by a couple of guys. K-O-U-Z-E-S is one. First one. Kuzis and Posner, I guess. That's the way you pronounce it. This book is an excellent book. They researched a whole bunch of major executives looking for the patterns that were present whenever they were at the best of their leadership. And they've come up with a list of leadership skills and ways to implement them that really relate to the core of leadership itself. Whenever I went through the first edition of this book, there were a lot of times, since I've studied the Bible for a long time, there are a lot of times at the end of the statement, I'd write a Bible reference. Because that's in the Bible. They have researched this extremely well and have a good picture of reality. Anytime you find a good picture of reality, you're going to find that it's very much like the Scriptures. So I'd strongly recommend it for you if you haven't read it. Leadership is not management. Management deals with processes. It's about organizing and monitoring what's going on, and you have to manage things that you start. The leadership has the ability to draw people around it and get people mobilized and moving a direction. And that book relates to those skills, the skills it takes to do that. A third thing is commitment. You have to be a person of commitment if you're going to be followed. If you're not a person of character and have the trust of people and have earned the trust and keep on demonstrating you're trustworthy, if you haven't done that, then people may follow because you're a department head or you're in charge of this section of this ministry over here or something else. But they always follow. You're blowing charge, and they're doing charge like this. They don't want to run too fast, unless they end up smacking into the wall out of your deceit. You have to be a person of character. You have to be competent. They will not charge hard behind you if they figure you don't know where you're going or you can't get there. But if you're not a person of commitment, they won't charge either. People need to know that you're committed to the task and committed to what you're doing. It's one of the struggles in midlife. In midlife, guys are reevaluating their commitments. Ladies are reevaluating their commitments. And it's easy to play what I think is Gene War called. I heard him call the uncertain trumpet. You know, that most devastating of all instruments. Where you're here blowing charge and then retreat. And you're back and forth. I'm not sure I want to do this. And it's it's very important you retain your leadership. If you are a husband, your children need to know that you're committed to them no matter what. Your wife needs to know you're committed to her no matter what. Now, if your kids think that your commitment to them is conditional, you just planted a landmine under your leadership whenever they hit teenage years. They need to know that you're committed to them. And I talk to my kids about that occasionally. We sit down and talk. You know, honey, sometimes daddy has to discipline you. But as long as I live, as long as I'm breathing, I'm going to be your daddy and I'm going to love you. And I'm going to do everything I can to help you. And I want to keep on telling them that. I need to do what's right. I need to lead them to do what's right. But I will do the hard thing it takes to see them move on in life. My wife and I made a decision that we would never bring up the word divorce, even in jest. We made that decision before we married, and that topic is never addressed between us. I don't know if she's ever thought about it or not, but I tell you, we don't talk about it. It is not an option. People who go into marriage wondering if this will work are going to find out it doesn't. Did you know there is no plan that you have that will work? Did you know that? Did you know plans don't work? People work. People work plans. The question is not, well, will our ministry on this campus go or will it not? The question is, are you going to make it go? Now, you know, if it's in the sovereign mind of God that for some reason it ain't going to go, then I would try to get that word first before I went there. Short of getting that word, I would decide it's going to go. You have to be committed to make this thing go. The question for me and Deborah on marriage is not, will it work? You know, we've been married 25 years now. But simply, how can we make it work? Will it work is a horrendous question. How can we make it work? You can answer that one. The question is not, will I love my children or will I help my children? The question is how. If you have a task before you and you're leading toward it, if you're a department head, and there are goals set and there are things that have to be done, then the question is not, can I do this, but how will I do this? Later on, you'll find out if you can or not. But the question you need to be asking is how and when. And you need to keep on pressing. If you will aggressively press toward what you need to do and are committed to it, then people will follow you. If you're doing this dance back and forth, well, I really don't know if I'm going to do this or not, then all your people are going to learn how to dance. They're not going to be worth much in the battle. You have to set your face, you have to set your mind, and you have to do this thing. And if you will do it, people will follow you. If you don't have your commitments nailed down, then your people are not nailed down either. Demonstrated character, competence, and commitment. These things have to be perceived. Like I said, it's not enough they be demonstrated. We really ought to put perceived right here. You may be a person of high character, but are just not showing it. People need to see that. Now, you don't need to go around calling attention all the time. Did you see what I did? I am a person of high character. Did you notice this? But I'm praying for God to open people's eyes to these things. There will also be moments whenever you have the perception that this is a moment when I'm being tested and I need to stand. Whenever you get that inner perception, you need to stand. Because you're on display for what you really are inside. And again, your commitment is not a matter of what you feel. You choose what you feel. You choose whether or not it'll dominate you. I've been in situations where I've been scared spitless and have gone ahead and acted against my fears with goosebumps all over my body and the hair standing up on the back of my neck. It's one thing to have the feelings of fear upon you. It's another thing to operate out of fear. It's one thing to just think in your heart of all the work it's going to take and just think, oh, groan. It's another thing to think, oh, groan, but here we go. Wow. You have to master the emotion. You have to set the pace to do what's right. If you will do it in the hard times, you'll retain your leadership. If you like to wimp out and go into, I have what my journal is entitled, The Journal of the Great Depression, because that's when I write in it. I go back and I review all those hard times that God took me through in the past, and it gives me some hope about this one. But if you're more inclined toward the downside or more inclined toward the upside, it doesn't matter what the feeling is. You have to set your face and do what's right. Jesus, whenever he heads for Jerusalem, sets his face toward Jerusalem. That means toward the cross he's going to go through. He's not just going to it, he's going through it. You know, the Bible says, he endured the shame for the joy that was set before him. There are a lot of hard things you walk through in life because it's right, and because on the other side of them, there's good for you and there's good for everybody else. You just have to set your face and do it. Three commitments. If these commitments get violated, they bring different kinds of problems. First of all, let's look. I'm sorry. I said three commitments. Let's put them down. They're basic commitments that a leader has. Number one, and these are in order of priority. These are priority commitments, leadership priorities. Number one is the mission. Number two is the welfare of the followers. Number three is your own welfare. And these are commitments that have to be made in the integrity of your heart, and they have to be lived out. Now, first of all, the mission. Now, there's a task that needs to be done. That's why your leadership exists. You may have to figure out what that is. If you are a husband, what is the mission for your family? Husband and wife, what is the mission for your family? What does God want out of your children? That needs to be a priority for you. My own family, our mission, my mission as a leader, it's to lead my family into doing the will of God in the earth. As I understand it, and I'm on track with that. A department head may have a certain quantity number set for him in units that have to be produced, or so much service has to be done, so many yards that have to be mowed, so many plants that have to be installed, or whatever. There may be a quantity here that have to lead their unit to accomplish this task. A lieutenant in battle may have to lead a platoon to take a hill, and that taking that hill may be very costly. But I have to have a commitment to the mission first, number one. Number two, to my followers, to the welfare of my followers. I have to take care of the people that are working with me. I have to look out to their interests and look at their welfare. Even if we're taking a hill in battle, and the price for taking that hill is that everybody in the platoon is going to die. We're going to lose 13 out of 15 people. Even at that, mission has to be first, and their welfare has to go ahead of mine. I will take care of them while they die, or I will die first. And then third is my own welfare. I do have to look out for my welfare. I do have to take care of myself, their interests. I do have to manage. But their welfare has to be ahead of mine. I have to look out for them first and then me. This is one of the big problems for husbands in leading in their homes. As I said last night, guys have discovered since the rebellion against God that life has more discipline than they want. And they like to work on the mission a while and then go play. After they finish working on the mission, they got a wife and kids to take care of if they're married and a father. And it's just a lot simpler just to go watch TV. Or if a guy is not into the spiritual realm, he'll go get a six-pack of beer and then watch TV. Sit down and watch a football game. Family's going bananas all around. Wife's pulling her hair out. He's watching football. What he's doing is he's communicating that he's out after his interest in the mission, and he's out after his convenience at home, and the rest of the family's not important. What Neil spoke about a few minutes ago, about Thursday. You remember that? Neil said Thursday. The guy walks down the hall and says to him, "Ah, Thursday." What Neil was saying in one way was that he realized he's communicating to students that he had this mission, and his own interest in this mission was ahead of his concern for these people. You see, for you as a leader, your personal interests are tied up in the mission, right? You want to see a ministry succeed. Now, your status is even tied up to the size of your ministry and what all goes on in it. So it's very easy to think you're dedicated to the mission, the task that you're trying to fulfill. Very easy to feel like that whenever in reality you're out for your own welfare. But you know what? Your followers sense the difference. They know what the score is. It's okay to be dedicated to the mission. As a matter of fact, one of the things good followers want from you as a leader is they want you to hold their feet to the fire. You know, my experience is my wife, I lead in our home, and I do a better job and a poorer job of it. But one of our experiences earlier on in marriage is my wife would challenge my leadership in certain areas where there were just things I felt like we really needed to do before God, and she'd challenge it. She had a different opinion. And we go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. There's no way to discuss this thing through. And finally I'd say, okay, we're at one of those points where we have to vote. And this may sound terribly chauvinistic, but I am president and CEO, that's two votes. And you just cast one, sweetheart. And this is the way we're going to go. Now Deborah knows that I've got a commitment, see. If we hit one of those points where we must move, and I cast the deciding vote, then I will live the rest of my life to pay the price for that vote. I will not run off and leave her holding the bag, and I will not blame things on her. I'll live the rest of my life, if it takes it, to dig out of the hole I got us in. Whenever we got married, we made a commitment to these things. And her commitment at those points is to whistle, "Nearer, my God, to thee as the ship goes down." And that's not an easy thing, friend. Yeah, if you've ever read a book called Christian Behavior by C.S. Lewis, if you haven't read it, you need to read it. Lewis says, you know, anything with two heads is a monster. Business can't run that way. Military can't run that way. Kingdom of God doesn't run that way. Nothing else in life does. Anything that has a human relationship where there's a dominant, uncaring, self-serving person ruling over others is an abomination to God. But there has to be leadership. And leadership has to bear responsibility. So we've hit very few points like that in life, but there have been a few. And this is my experience. At those times, whenever we hit those, the two or three times we hit those, what Deborah did was, whenever I finally said, "This is going to be it," Deborah would go, "Boy, that's over. I'm so glad." Nothing. This is really perverse. Here, I'm trying to lead us this way, and you're trying to drag me this way. And we never did exactly figure out why that happens. But, you know, good followers want leaders to bear responsibility and lead and take them toward the mission. I found out later, especially, wives desire husbands to listen to them and be able to give input. I learned to do that fairly well. You can talk to my wife about how well. But what I'm saying is you have to push your followers. If you don't push your followers to go after the mission, they have no respect for you. If you're a boss and workers keep coming to you saying things like, "My dog died yesterday and I need to bury it today, can I have the day off?" And you realize that they've had three dogs the last 3 weeks. And you're just so compassionate for people and you're just so concerned for people until you just sort of hate to say no. And you say, "Oh, sure, take the day off." How do you feel about that kind of boss? You have no respect for them. I mean, you enjoy the fact they're your boss because you can just walk all over them. But you have no respect for them. You begin to despise the mission after a while. Bosses need to hold people's feet to the fire. Leaders need to hold people's feet to the fire. At the same time, their welfare has to go ahead of mine. Whenever a leader has his own welfare above his followers, how do you feel about that kind of leader? You know he's really committed to the production for the department, and it is going to happen. But on the way there, he's going to take care of himself and not you. How do you feel about that kind of leader? He's a hireling, not a shepherd. You don't trust him? You feel used? Yeah, you know, when the chips are down, you're hanging at the end of the rope. So you keep trying to find the rope and hide it. Now, counter strategy develops. People develop ways to go around the leader. And they're always watching their backs. There are wives whose husbands have convinced them that they're out for number three above number two. Those women are always watching their backs and decisions. There are kids whose fathers have convinced them that they're out for their own welfare and they don't care about what the kids feel and think and what happens to them. So they're always watching their backs whenever daddy's speaking. There are churches whose pastors have convinced them they're out for their own welfare and will look after themselves first and not the flock. That kind of pastor can blow charge, and everybody says, "That's nice. Would you do a solo on Sunday for us?" Nobody's going to charge, but it's a pretty solo. They want to get up and preach like that. Makes them feel good, but they're not going to do anything. There are department heads who do this kind of thing. They put their own welfare above the welfare of others, and the whole department spends about a third of its time just in the anxiety of not knowing when they're going to be at loss. Whenever someone puts their own welfare above the mission, what happens? You know the boss is going to take care of himself no matter what happens to the company. How do you feel about that kind of boss? What do? Now, you don't want to pay the price either. What else? Now, you don't want to be standing close when the bomb goes off from upstairs. The mission's a joke. It's often at this point that you just get full-scale rebellion. Now, a wife feels like a husband doesn't care anything about God anymore. He's not concerned about God. He's trying to exert leadership, being a hypocrite. The husband's got full-scale rebellion on his hands. Same thing with kids. That's where employee buyouts take place in companies. So what I'm saying to you is, If you want to be a spiritual leader, you want to lead even in the human realm, mission is first, welfare of followers, then your own welfare. All leaders have to do this. Number one, they set direction. Number two, they start the group. Number three, they have to keep it on track. Number four, they give an account to the authorities over them. CEOs have to do this. Department foremen have to do this. Pastors have to do this. Campus ministers have to do this. Bible study leaders have to do this. So you set direction. If you're a department head or, say, a shift foreman at work, the goals have already been set by someone else. What you do is you assent, yes, on this shift we're going to do these goals, gang. You have set direction at that point. You accepted direction from above. If you're a CEO, you may spend a year and a half as a new CEO in a multinational corporation just figuring out direction. But you set direction for the next 10 years. Starting the group, if you're head of a lawn mowing crew and you got to do so many lawns today, you've already set direction. What you do is say, okay, boys, mount up. Everything goes on the trucks and away we go. You started the group. If you're CEO of a multinational corporation, it may take 2 years of dinners and vice presidents' retreats to get everyone sort of headed out in the same direction, but you've done it. A Bible study leader says it's time to get started, and we're off and away. The person who won't take the initiative to start the group just makes everybody anxious. You ever go to one of those meetings where it ought to start? You know, it should have started 30 minutes ago. And nobody has nerve to say, okay, let's pull out our Bibles. I've gone to a few of those meetings. Keeping on track, you keep on track through three things: evaluation, motivation, and discipline. You look at where you're supposed to be going, check, see where you're at. You have to motivate people, everybody runs down. And then it's normal for people to get off track, and you have to bring correction and pull things back on. If you want to be a leader, you're going to be doing evaluation, motivation, and discipline. If you don't know how to do those well, you need to learn. There are five levels of leadership. Number one, lowest level, is job description. John Maxwell has put these together. Whenever you're new into a group, they'll accept you based on your job description. You're department head, you are department head, period. You don't have influence yet. You just have institutional privilege and authority. And they'll follow you within the job description. They may do the minimum because they have to. You can try to inspire them to great visions. They're not going to follow you yet because they don't know you yet. If you're new on campus, you have a job description and nobody is impressed with it. Second level is relationships. You build relationships, people start following you because they like you. At the job description level, it's because they have to. Church hires a pastor, they have to listen to you preach. If you're the department head, they have to listen to you talk. Now they have to listen to your orders. If they like you, they begin to follow in addition because they like you. But in order for them to like you, you have to build relationships. So you do things outside of hours with people. Third is production for the organization. Let's call it. Whenever people start looking at the organization saying it's improved because you've been here, you have greater authority. So if you go into a new ministry position, you have a job description, no one's impressed with it. You start building relationships, more and more people want to follow you because they see who you are, they begin to believe you. And then the organization starts improving because you've been around. They can see some visible results. At that point, those who have leadership begin to follow you because they see you're actually going to do some things. Fourth level is reproduction. This is where you've trained people and their own lives have changed because of, this is personal impact, personal production. Their own lives have changed because of you being around. If you're in business, you've mentored someone, and they can see how their own careers improve because of you. That person is very highly loyal to you. You have a lot of leadership in their lives. Number five is, I'm just going to call it legend. This is where you become larger than life. You represent something like Billy Graham. Billy Graham walked into the room, there'd be a lot of respect turned that direction. Because this man stood the test of time, he represents something far bigger than himself. And not too many people get to this point. A man who marries a wife has a job description of husband. He better be spending some time with her. And after a little while, she better see that life is better because she married him. Okay, you catch? Kids have a guy around who has a job description of father. You better be spending time with him. After a while, they need to see that, yeah, you know, life really is good because this character is around. Without that, all you have is the demand and punishment, reward and punishment of the office of father. So what I'm saying to you is, these things flow all across life. I could share all kinds of verses with you about these. Maybe we could do that in the next session. You can ask questions about them. But these flow, whether it's marriage and parenting, whether it's church. These are the principles that affect leadership on all levels. They especially impact volunteer leadership, leadership in the volunteer arena. The one who can lead well in the volunteer arena will do quite well in business, because they've learned how to deal with the hearts of people, not just the harsh externalities. The best of business leadership looks a great deal like what you find in Scripture. If you can lead in your home, Scripture says, you can lead in the church. And the reason is the same principles apply across the board. What we have here is one goal, two sources of authority, three commitments, four tasks, and five levels. Okay, we're going to quit because of time. We can take some questions in the next session. Okay, three ways to keep the group on track. Number one is evaluation. You have to evaluate where you're at. Are we where we need to be at this point? Shift foreman would look at the number of units produced halfway through the shift. Motivation. You know, people, the normal thing is to start well and to run down. And it's up to the leader to go around, keep spirits lifted, keep people inspired. And the third thing is discipline. That's bringing correction. That needs to be done with a great deal of grace and an atmosphere of tremendous encouragement, but you still have to discipline people. So evaluation, motivation, and discipline. Those are three skills that you do well to learn. We'll take questions in the next time about these things. Thank you for your attention.